Welcome to LP Collage Out in the Arts. I'm Gary Carnevale here in the KRCB studios live with Mary Moore Campagna. Thank you for tuning in on this soggy evening. We hope wherever you are in the North Bay or elsewhere, you're safe and dry. Tonight I'll chat with author Matt Cain about his delightful new novel, The Secret Life of Albert Entwistle. Later we'll have a conversation with Grace Kent, who will perform Wednesday evening in Forbidden Kiss Live, a sexy vaudeville cabaret burlesque and comedy show at the California in Santa Rosa. We wish you all a happy 2023. This is our first show of the new year. We're getting a lot of rain, much needed, but still creating hazardous conditions all over the state, especially with our friends at the Russian River, near the river, and near big creeks. Please stay informed by listening to local news here on KRCB 104.9 FM. We at Northern California Public Media are committed to keeping our community well informed. Our amazing news department works nonstop to get you the latest information about the weather, road conditions, evacuation notices, and so much more. You can listen to KRCB for your news, for the news you need, on our free app. Download it from the Apple Store or Google Play for your smartphone. Through the app, you are able to listen live if you are unable to get our signal. Otherwise, we're here at 104.9 FM with our most powerful signal ever. Timely news stories, features, a calendar of local events, and our radio and TV show schedules are all available on our website, norcalpublicmedia.org. While there, you can become a member. KRCB is public radio for Sonoma County. We appreciate your support. Up now, Greg Moralia with Outbeat Radio News.
Members appointed by Democrats will immediately be removed. And while it's possible for House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries to appoint new board members, doing so is a slow process. The rules also state that any of the new Office of Ethics Investigation staff must be hired within 30 days of the rules passing, meaning if anyone leaves after the 30-day mark, they cannot be replaced at all during the 118th Congress. Santos, who already has multiple ethics complaints filed against him regarding campaign finance violations, told Business Insider that he thinks the changes are, quote, fantastic. After being elected to represent New York's 3rd Congressional District and becoming the first out gay Republican elected to Congress, Santos's life story came crumbling down as several newspapers reported that he never went to college that he said he attended, never worked for major banks that he said he worked for, and had been lying about his family history as well. He admitted to many of these lies, calling them, quote, a little bit of fluff, end quote. He's also being investigated by authorities in Brazil for writing bad checks. And in Texas, Republicans have introduced two bills that would ban instruction of sexual orientation and gender identity in the state's public schools. Among the 35 anti-LGBTQ plus bills filed so far by Texas Republicans for the 2023 legislative session, two mirror Florida's parental rights and education law, otherwise known as the Don't Say Gay law. House Bill 631, authored by State Representative Steve Toth, would ban schools from teaching about sexual orientation or gender identity from kindergarten through fifth grade. Representative Jared Patterson's version of that bill extends the ban through eighth grade. In a January 3rd statement announcing House Bill 1155, Patterson characterized the bill as a, quote, improved version of Florida's law, and use both the now familiar language of parental rights and misleading rhetoric about sexualizing children. Quote, the sexualization of our children must stop, he said. And he added, quote, parents and taxpayers have spoken loudly over the past year plus. The message is no more radical ideology in the classroom, particularly when it comes to inappropriate or obscene content, end quote. Critics say that these bills could have far-reaching effects for LGBTQ plus students, teachers, and school districts. Audrey Perez, an organizing director with Texas Freedom Network, said the reality is that everybody has a gender identity and sexual orientation, and avoiding these conversations is incredibly difficult. She explained that the bill becomes a tool leveraged specifically against LGBTQI plus people, because what stands out is not the people that fit in, but the people who are being specifically targeted and attacked for being different. Perez also warned that the vague language in the bills could create a legal gray area wherein a teacher could be criminalized or attacked or removed from their job doing what they love. And here locally, according to the Bay Area Reporter, a gay married dad with long ties to the Bay Area has been named the new superintendent for the Golden Gate National Recreation Area. The sprawling federal park site spans the counties of San Mateo, San Francisco, and Marin. David Smith, who's a 31-year veteran of the National Park Service, is set to become the new permanent superintendent later this month. He will be the third LGBTQ leader of the 82,000-acre park over the past 8 years. Since 2014, Smith has been the superintendent of the Joshua Tree National Park in Southern California. He and his husband, John Evans, have two adult sons, Jekiah and Dante. Smith is described as a proven innovator, community builder, inclusive leader, and a devoted land manager. For a calendar of LGBT events happening here in the North Bay, go to gaysonoma.com. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moralia. I'd love to change the world, but I don't know what to do.
Matt Cain is a writer, broadcaster, and leading commentator on LGBTQ plus issues. He currently hosts a discussion show, Sunday Roast, on Virgin Radio Pride. The Secret Life of Albert Entwistle is Matt's fourth novel, actually his fifth. He just told me that he's finished his fifth novel. Albert, of course, is his fourth. And we welcome you to Outbeat Collage, Matt.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
It's wonderful to see you. Matt is coming to us from London, England.
It's been raining all day in London, England. It is now pitch black because it's already night time at 5:10. So you are brightening up my early evening.
Well, you have no idea how gloomy it is here. It's dreadful. We've been having rain for about 3 weeks, so it's sort of London weather here.
I don't believe you, Gary. I've been to California. It's always been glorious.
It never rains in California. There used to be a song. Well, they lie sometimes. To begin with, you were recently married, so best wishes to you and your spouse, Harry.
Thank you. Can you believe? Finally, I'm a respectable woman at the age of 48. It only took me nearly 5 decades to get there, but I did manage it in the end.
That's amazing.
It was great. I mean, it is funny, actually. I mean, I'm making light of it, but I don't know how many of your listeners are single or happily attached, but you know, I was looking for love for so long. I ended up going around the block quite a few times and having disappointment, and I don't know, when all your peers and siblings and friends find their love, you get to an age and you think it's not going to happen for you. And actually, when I turned 40, I kind of made peace with the fact that it might not happen for me. And then a few years later, I just went on yet another Tinder date, and it just happened. I mean, it's weird, isn't it, thinking about it? But funnily enough, a lot of those feelings of, I don't know if loneliness, well, yeah, loneliness, but that makes it sound like I was sitting at home having a pity party the whole time. But, you know, just like wanting to be loved and wanting to find love, a lot of that I did channel into Albert Entwistle, the novel. And also, actually, the man that I've ended up marrying didn't come out until his 40s. He had his own personal story and reasons why he concealed his sexuality. And I did, when I was writing it, tap into all of that and, you know, get under his skin and emotionally what he was going through and channel all that into the book. I'm really sorry if you can hear a wailing in the background. It's actually my cat. Now that she can, now that she's up like the other side of the apartment, but now that she can hear me talking, she's just like wailing for me to come and give her treats.
Oh, that's cute. That's cute. Well, I must say, out of the gate, this was probably my favorite book of 2022.
It's so touching, warm, and full of life and love. Tell our listeners a bit about the engaging story and your adorable protagonist, Albert the Postman.
Thank you, Gary. Well, I can just say you're my favorite interviewer so far in 2023. Out of the gate. Well, so what can I tell you about The Secret Life of Albert Entwistle? It's about a lonely, unhappy, and secretly gay postman, as you say. He has a series of life crises and they make him want to turn things around. And he decides he finally wants to be happy. He knows that if this is going to happen for the first time in his life at the age of 64, what he has to do is go back and confront an unresolved trauma. And he has to go back and find the lost love of his life, a man he hasn't seen for nearly 50 years. And I'm not going to reveal whether or not he finds him, but I will say that along the way, he reconnects with his community. He's shut himself off from the world for a long time, but he makes new friends with people he thought were going to be very different and were very different to him, but actually he realizes they have a lot in common. So it is, I hope it is life affirming and inspiring. It's about second chances, grabbing any second chances life may throw at you. It's about it never being too late to find the happiness you deserve, to pursue your dream, to find love, to fix any regrets or make amends or correct mistakes. And actually, funnily enough, even though it was published in the UK a while ago now, I actually think that this time of year, when you're thinking about a new year, chance for reinvention, self-improvement, it does tend to resonate a lot with readers around this time. So it's great to be talking to you about it now.
It's so true. I went back home to Chicago for Christmas, which I haven't done in a long time, and had your book with me. And loved reading it at Christmas time. It was, you know, the literary version of It's a Wonderful Life for me. I got to enjoy this beautiful story. I didn't want to put it down, literally, and I didn't want it to end. And in the book, you include segments of interviews you conducted with men who grew up in rural England, like Albert, and who came out late in life, like your husband. Did these stories inspire you to write the book, or did you conduct them after you had written the book?
Oh, good question. It's actually a bit of both. So I used to be the editor-in-chief of Attitude, which is the big gay magazine here in the UK. And I was editor in 2017 when we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the start of decriminalisation. And when that was happening, I interviewed a lot of gay men who had been sexually active before decriminalisation and who therefore had been prosecuted, sent to prison, given chemical castration, rejected by their families, fired from their jobs, electric shock therapy. You name it, a roll call of horror stories. And I can't remember how it happened, but these stories definitely inspired me to think about writing a fictional story that would cover similar ground. And I can't remember what happened, but I think I must have been talking about this to my editor, because it was my editor for fiction, because it was her idea for me to include some of these real life stories. So I went back to one or two of the original men and I found some more, and that's where those stories came from. But I have to say, Gary, it never ceases to amaze me, straight people in particular. I mean, young gay people, young queer people tend to be quite aware of our history and the cultural legacy, but often straight people have absolutely no idea. And I'm very lucky being on social media, because readers quite often get in touch with me to say that they've enjoyed one of my books. But I get approached practically on a daily basis with people telling me they've read these interviews and they had no idea that any of this had happened. No idea it was ever illegal, you know, that we had to kind of live in this underworld, that we used to hear things like queers can't love, and we grew up thinking we were unworthy of love, and we treated ourselves disrespectfully as a consequence of that, and just all the hard facts of, you know, like we were saying earlier, losing your job, being sent to prison, being prosecuted, having your name and all the details put in the local paper so your family would disown you. It was horrendous. And I don't know, it's interesting with Albert because he's quite a gentle, sweet character, and he draws people into the book like a warm hug, or certainly that's how it's designed. But what I then want to do is follow it up with a bit of a punch. You know, when readers are kind of relaxed and just having that kind of warm glow of spending time in Albert's company, to actually then hit them with some hard political facts and the horrors of history in the fictional narrative, as well as these interviews at the end. Because I think it's important, if people don't know about these things, it's up to me and you to let them know.
That was going to be one of my next questions, but I love how you were able to weave in queer history through Albert's and George's stories, quite poignant, quite traumatic, as you can imagine. Gay life was during the 40s, 30s, 40s, 50s.
Absolutely, and I do think it's important to I don't set out to educate people when I write a novel. It's about moving them. And for me, anyway, taking them on a journey, exciting, thrilling them, but really moving them. I like entertaining as well. I do like fun. But I don't know. I think if you're going to write authentically about any gay experience over the last 50 years or so, it's going to have a dark undercurrent just because of the horrors we were subjected to. And I think it's important that people know this. But I think what I also wanted to do, Gary, is... I wanted to celebrate how far we've come because I'm in my 40s. I grew up in the 80s at the height of the HIV/AIDS crisis and all the homophobia it unleashed, the hysterical responses from certain people in mainstream straight society. And I never for one minute imagined things could get so much better. I never imagined I'd be talking to you in San Francisco, near San Francisco, about a book I've had published in America that straight readers are reading in the thousands and celebrating. I just never imagined it. I wanted to write a book that would make everyone feel proud of the role that they've played in bringing on society and moving things forward, even if it's just accepting the gay co-worker 10, 20 years ago, or gay brothers, uncles, nephews, neighbours, or, you know, just like, I don't know, being into Will and Grace 20 years ago. I just want every, you know, it's been such a long journey. It's taken so many of us. And also, we couldn't have done it on our own, could we? We needed straight allies to be on our side, to move things forward, to speak for us when we didn't have a voice. And I want all those people to feel proud of the role that they've played. I wanted the book to be a celebration.
It is a celebration, and it's so beautiful, such a beautiful story. And you always bring me to my next question.
Maybe that's because I used to do your job.
Exactly. You know how it works. But I was going to say, every character is so well developed, even if it's just a glimpse, even if it's a coworker that has maybe 20 lines of dialogue and is in just a handful of scenes, they come to life so beautifully. And especially Nicole, who befriends Albert. Talk about what it takes to develop characters so thoroughly that any reader can relate to them.
Oh, that's really nice you should say that, because when I signed the publishing deal for Albert Entwistle in America, I was so excited, but part of me did think the setting is so specific. It's so deeply rooted in the northwest of England and the working class culture there, which is a background that I come from and still dip in and out of every few weeks because my family are all still there. So I know it very well. So I can write it easily and authentically. But at the same time, I didn't know how these characters would resonate in America, you know, in California. But that's like one of the greatest joys of me for writing. I absolutely love creating characters and building them up, plotting their emotional development.
Especially Nicole, who ends up really becoming Albert's friend, a complete stranger.
Yeah, she's a complete stranger, and she, on the surface, I was looking for somebody who, on the surface, would seem completely different from him. And she's 19, she's a woman of colour, she's a single mother, but she's also lonely. She's shy, and, you know, it always strikes me that black girls and young women in the narrative arts are often represented as the kind of sassy streetwise one. I kind of think, well, what about the shy, quiet one? And the interesting thing with this character, I think, is she's a shy, quiet one, but because everybody assumes she's a young black woman, so she's basically going to be sassy and, they assume she's being standoffish and not very friendly. She's just shy and vulnerable and quiet. And the other thing about her was, I've always been very close to my grandparents, particularly my grandmothers. And believe it or not, at the age of 48, I still have one who's going to turn 101.
Oh, my goodness.
Her name is Irene. So I named the youngest character in the book after her.
Oh.
She's the youngest character in my life. And I've always been close to them. I was very lucky. I grew up with both sets of grandparents very nearby, and I would see them all the time. And I've got six nephews and nieces, and I've seen their relationship with their grandparents. I think it's a really special relationship. Nicole was very close to her grandma and is missing her when the book opens. So Albert comes along and she's drawn to him in a way that we don't explain too explicitly, but I think is because she's missing her grandma and she's missing that kind of special energy you get from an older person in your life. How's that for an answer? You're nodding.
I love that. Yes, I love that. Well, a couple points come to me. And, you know, people think, especially people in other countries think, oh, you know, America is the big, you know, the big city, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Miami, Chicago, New York, all of these gay people, everyone has sort of this big city experience where, no, most of the people that live in those cities now are from smaller rural areas or the Midwest. I think that's
really interesting because when I was growing up, there used to be a song which was a big hit in this country. I don't know if you know it, though. It was called Small Town Boy by Bronski Beat.
Of course.
And it was basically, it explored a key stage of the gay experience, which was almost necessary for everyone, which was when you realise you're gay, you have to get out and get to the big city. It is interesting because you do in big cities get people from all these different backgrounds. But what's happening now, and this was another reason I wanted to write the book, is people don't have to leave those small towns or rural settings now. They can stay. The town that I'm from, Bolton, in the northwest of England, I basically had to get out to become the person I was meant to be, to find the happiness I deserved. But I still go back all the time, and they started Bolton Pride in about 2015, 5 or 6 years ago. I can't remember exactly, but they invited me back to do a speech at the first one. And it was quite an emotional time for me because I stood there on the town hall steps reading about how I just had to get out of that place to become myself. And now I'm back there talking about how wonderful it is that gay people can be proud in that town.
Yes.
And I think it is important to have those experiences represented.
Yes, yes. The patchwork of the LGBTQI++ community is broad and diverse. And it's good for us to always sort of remember that, those of us that live in areas with a high concentration of gay folks, that there are still people in small towns. Bolton is a happy story in the United States here. We have some not so happy stories, especially when it comes to trans folks in certain states. I'll name one, Texas, Florida, amazingly. And these are huge states with huge queer populations where the state government has decided to target us. That's my soapbox standing for the interview. But
no, I think you're very right to get on the soapbox. And I find it really upsetting. It's interesting when it happens in another country because, you know, it's easy to look and think and see what other people are doing wrong. And isn't it terrible that in certain states of America this is happening? But our country, last year or the year before, a gay doctor was beaten to death in a homophobic attack in a park in Cardiff. You know, there's still pockets of homophobia, queerphobia. You know, there's lots of reasons for it. And it can be horrendous and horrendously upsetting, but also galvanizing. And those kind of things do inspire me to write the kind of books that I write. I think it's really important to remember that those kind of things still happen, however regrettably that may be.
The story is just so engaging, and I love the tone you set. It's sort of the story about sort of a quiet, reserved man, but as it builds, the tension sort of builds, the secret is sort of revealed. It still maintains this sort of calmness as he's confronting his past and coming out. He becomes more centered and he becomes more comfortable with himself and with telling his story to others.
Yes, you're right. And there is a sweetness and a gentleness to it, tonally. Even though I like to think I don't hold back from confronting some of the darker elements of our shared history as queer people. But yeah, I did want to do that. I have to say I shamelessly wanted a very mainstream hit with this book. You know, I wanted to be speaking to readers who were open to our stories and our emotional journeys without necessarily having all the detail or knowledge. I don't know, I kind of, you know, so in the UK next week, my next book is being published and I've got a big deal with a big publisher and I'm finishing the book after that, which is coming out in January 2024. And, you know, I've got the weight of a big publisher behind me now and they want to do this build over three books. And we're just giving it everything we've got. And it isn't lost on me that if things can continue to go well and the success builds, then we can actually have a big cultural impact and you can change attitudes. And that does feel great to be a part of that. But to go back to your original point, the gentleness, the sweetness, actually what is happening is over the course of the three books, they get slightly less gentle and a bit more bawdy and knockabout and riotous. So we're luring in the readers. Listen to us two cackling. We're luring them in order to hit them with the punch.
Exactly. You know, I'm a little older than you are, but I remember when, you know, when gay lit really happened, when Edmund White's A Boy's Own Story came out and Felice Pachano and the Purple Quill Gang started getting published. And I was seeing those books in bookstores as a 15-year-old or 16-year-old and thinking, wow, what's this? And finding this other world, you know, used to be in the shadows and we didn't talk about that. And it opened a world to me. So it's wonderful that you've got a publisher committed to that and to reaching a wide audience that isn't just queer.
Yes, but I have to say, I don't take it for granted because I had about 10 years of rejection. Books being knocked back. And it's interesting, some of the examples that you use. I love authors like Edmund White. I'm very into reading the queer classics. But what publishers often said to me in the early days of me writing, they often said to appeal to readers, books about gay characters and gay themes need to be literary. And you can't write mainstream commercial, I'm doing inverted commas, down market, the lighter end. They just have to be very intelligent, literary, the kind of books that win awards and are taken very seriously. I used to think, I actually don't agree with that. I think maybe when I started out, there weren't many examples of, you know what it's like in publishing, everything's split into literary and commercial, as if the same people don't read both at different times, depending on their mood and whether they want a relaxed read on a holiday or they want something more challenging. But they used to say, it's only very educated people who read literary fiction who are open to queer stories. Housewives who shop at Asda or your Walmart or whatever would... they're not open to these kind of stories. And I used to think I didn't have the ammunition to prove them wrong. But what happened was in other art forms, TV, pop music, film, they started to prove the opposite earlier than in publishing. And it took a while to catch up. Now, commercial books are enjoying great success about queer themes and about queer stories and characters. Things like The Gunkle in, Stephen Rowley in the States. I love that book, love him. You know, actually, it's so patronising for people to say that less educated people are going to be more bigoted and not as open emotionally. I mean, what a load of rubbish. And actually, it took us a while, writers, but we're very much proving that wrong now. And I love being a part of that.
Excellent. Well, you know, here in San Francisco, we had Armistead Maupin with his Tales of the City that was originally printed in the newspaper as a column and became this huge global phenomenon.
I know. And I once came to San Francisco to interview him. And I interviewed him. He put in his memoir, was it called Logical Family? I was interviewing him for Attitude, I think. And there was an episode in the book where he talked about a failed sexual encounter with Rock Hudson. I interviewed him in that hotel room. I asked for the Rock Hudson suite because it's the room he always used to stay in. And while I was there, I went around looking at inspiration for Barbary Lane and, you know, all the kind of locations. And I was a bit young to experience the Tales of the City books firsthand of the moment. I got them later. Yeah, you would have thought they would have proven the point. But when there was only one example, people could say, oh, that's an anomaly. Also, right. this isn't a criticism, actually, far from it. But I'm going to say something a bit controversial. It surprises me when I reread the early Tales of the City books that they're slightly less gay than I thought. At the time, there's a lot of, what's the lead character? She's called Marianne yes. Singleton. I think the later ones, he had the confidence and the freedom to bring his queer characters, is it Michael Tolliver, to the front, the forefront much more. But in the early, I'm not trying to invalidate what he did. It was an amazing achievement. They're slightly less queer than I remember the early ones.
There's a documentary about him. I don't know if you've seen it, and or maybe in the book, but maybe I've read it in an interview. But he said the editor of the newspaper would stand there with the scenes that he's written, and he would say, gay, straight, we can't have we can't have more queer scenes than we do straight scenes. So he was sort of forced.
That doesn't surprise me, but that's fascinating. But that was in the 70s, and then flash forward to the early 2000s when I started writing, and I was basically getting, I was going to say the same, attitude, actually even worse, because they didn't want, well, what I used to be told was, write books with a female central character and have a nice gay best friend. That's what I used to be told, which I suppose is a kind of similar thing.
Right.
You know, Marianne Singleton was the lead originally. We all misremember it a bit.
Yes.
But, you know, we fought and eventually won that battle, and thankfully for as younger queer writers, he did, because he paved the way.
He really did. And there were great screen versions of it. A very long story about Tales of the City on PBS, which is a hysterical story, but look it up yourself. But I find Albert and his story so cinematic. Have you had interest in it turning it into a series or a film?
Well, funny you should say that. I can't reveal too much, but a deal has been done. And the interesting thing is, what do you think about this, Gary? The producers would like to edge up Albert so that he's been able to cling on to his job for longer. He's now in his 70s, but they're forcibly retiring him because of ill health. And they think that actually, if they do that, his experience of love in his teens would have happened pre-legalization. It would therefore pack a bigger punch. And they pointed out that 64 isn't actually that old anymore. And doesn't really look that old on screen. And it could be more poignant for the cinema version if he were to be aged up. And I actually thought that was a great idea. What do you think?
It's not a bad idea at all. No, they have some good points. Well, congratulations. That's amazing.
Thank you very much. Thank you for reading it so enthusiastically and being so engaged and responding so positively.
Of course, I'm recommending it to everyone. I'm not giving my copy to anyone because I want to keep it and cherish it. Just lovely. Do you want to tell us about the new book?
Oh, the new book was inspired by a British film called Shirley Valentine. And an American series, which I watched all of it in the various lockdowns, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. And they're both about downtrodden wives breaking free to pursue their dreams. And I wanted to write a gay version. So my version is about a 40-something gay man who's dumped by his husband, devastated, but then starts to realise, actually, my husband suppressed my sparkle and held me back. And crucially, held me back from pursuing my long-held dream, which is becoming a drag queen. So my character, Ted, sets off to pursue his dream at the age of 43 and may or may not find love again along the way. But it's got it's a similar setting. It's in the northwest of England, working class setting, although it's actually in a fictional seaside town this time. It's about low self-esteem, growing up, being made to feel that you're not good enough, and how this can stop you from putting yourself forward, putting yourself first in life, but finally breaking free from that to grab all the chances life is throwing at us, even if you may think you're of an age when those chances are drying up.
I love it. I love it.
That's a new book. And it's called, the character's called Ted. I wanted to call it Ted Over Heels. the publisher has decided to call it Becoming Ted. And that's published here in the UK next week.
Amazing. Amazing. And then how much longer will it take to get here to the States?
I don't know. We have done the deal and it is all signed, but you've just reminded me to check in with my American publisher and find out. Because I want it to happen quickly.
Right, right. Well, you should. You should. And we all want that too. But we should still be able to buy it if it's been published in England, like on Amazon or through our bookstores. Shouldn't we here in the States?
They do something called an export edition, but to be honest, I don't quite know how it works in terms of if there's already a deal for an American edition, but there will be advanced reading copies, hopefully quite soon.
Oh, great.
Get on to my publisher. I'm sorry I'm not there because I could sign your copies and give you nice messages.
Oh, I love it.
Don't do any of that from this distance.
I love
tell
it.
Tell my publisher they need to fly me out to America to do a promotional tour.
You're reading my mind. I was just going to say that.
You know what? I would love to come back to San Francisco as a published author. I've been there about 3 times. And the last time I was there, I did a guided tour of the Castro and going around all the locations for queer history. And it was brilliant. I absolutely loved it. I've had many a night out there and I would love more. I'd love to come back with my husband now to keep me out of mischief.
And we all know the mischief one can get into in San Francisco.
We do indeed.
That's great. Well, great chatting with you. So do you have a website and Instagram and all that stuff you want people to follow you?
I'm on Instagram, Twitter as at Matt Cain Writer. MattCain Writer. And that also happens to be the address of my website.
Perfect. 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 Well, thank you so much for all you do for the queer community and for writing these wonderful books. Now, so you're working on your sixth novel now, I think you mentioned.
Yes, I'm working on the sixth, which is even more gay, even louder.